It's Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name's Olivia Rosenman, and this week we're having an in-depth discussion on data retention and the media with three specialists in the field. Bernard Keane is Crikey's political editor. Hi, Bernard.
Hi there.
Bruce Baer-Arnold is the Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Canberra. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
And joining me in the studio is the Chief Executive Officer of Communications Alliance, John Stanton.
Good afternoon.
Today, Thursday the 13th of April, marks the final deadline for Australian internet service providers and telcos to retain users' metadata for at least 2 years. The requirement to do so was legislated in an amendment to the Telecommunications Interception and Access Act, changes that were announced by Tony Abbott in 2014 as part of the government's effort to combat terrorism. The new laws passed through Parliament with bipartisan support. So let's begin this conversation by focusing on the telecommunications providers and the data itself. John, Communications Alliance is the primary telecommunications industry body in Australia, representing a wide cross-section of the communications industry. Can you explain what exactly the changes to the Telecommunications Act require of these industry providers?
Well, they require the providers to retain a data set for a period of 2 years. And broadly, that data set relates to six categories of information. The subscriber information, who the customer is who's making the communication, the source of that communication, the destination, the date and the time and the duration of a communication, the type of communication it is, and the location of communications equipment. So those six categories break out into a pretty vast data set relating to all of the different types of services that providers offer in Australia.
Communications Alliance mission statement is to promote the growth of the Australian communications industry and the protection of consumer interests. Now, you have been quite vocal in your opposition to data retention. So how does it obstruct those goals?
Well, I guess our principal objection throughout has been one of proportionality as to whether the real burden being placed on industry and let's face it, the potential risk to personal privacy is justified by the degree of increase in national security that might come from this data retention regime. And also the fact that it is onerous, it's complicated, and we've chosen to be a world leader in terms of the duration that the data is required to be retained for. Typically around the world where there is a data retention regime, it might be a requirement to keep the data for 6 months or maybe 12, which is more in line with the timeframes that law enforcement agencies tend to work on when they're looking for this sort of metadata to solve crimes.
Let's focus on today's deadline. Communications Alliance has called on the government to assist providers to meet that deadline rather than punishing those who have not. Why is this? Haven't they had ample time to put their systems in place?
They've had a torrid time, but not necessarily ample time. Once the legislation was passed, we spent a great deal of time working with government to try and clarify what it actually meant. There were many ambiguities and elements of lack of clarity within the legislation, and a lot of interpretation required when you looked service by service at what needed to be retained and what didn't need to be retained. So that was the first part of figuring out how to comply with this regime. Then we waited about 500 days for the promised industry grants to subsidise the capital cost of providers to comply, to be worked through the system. And then the providers had to wait further for the first part of that money to come through. And a lot of smaller providers really stopped their compliance program until they could understand how much of that would be subsidised. You know, you've got more than 350 providers in Australia. Many of them are small. And to start embarking on building new systems and processes in an environment where you don't know how much your business is going to have to fund of that amount, and you've got a little business, you know, could actually imperil your financial, you know, viability. So there was a bit of almost a game of chicken going on where the providers were trying to figure out, you know, how long they could wait before restarting their efforts and still being able to meet this deadline. And as a result, some have struggled. Also, even some of the really big providers who started working on this immediately in early 2015 found that as they got further into the process, you know, they encountered complexities they hadn't anticipated and really big challenges to be compliant. So that's why we've said to the government, look, you know, the delays that government has imposed throughout these 2 years have made it harder for providers to comply. So you should act reasonably now, exercise a bit of regulatory constraint, focus on a cooperative relationship to help providers get across the line rather than coming down on them like a ton of bricks.
And how many of those, did you say 350 providers? How many of those do you think aren't going to have made today's deadline?
I can't hazard a guess, really. I know that many have, and I suspect that many are still trying to get across the line.
Another concern that has been raised is that the law doesn't require the data to be stored in Australia, and that the cheapest place to store it will probably be China. Bruce, does this mean that Australians' communication data is not actually protected by the Australian legal system?
It means it's protected, but not very effectively. This is bad legislation, badly implemented. The Attorney General, George Brandis, who was pushing it, was unable to clearly explain what, you know, the basic notion of metadata. Industry, academics, ordinary people have yet to have a clear explanation of why this is necessary, of whether it's going to work. And indeed, if we look overseas, the regime seems to be grossly disproportionate. If we look at Europe, high-level courts there have consistently said this is not necessary. It's disproportionate. It makes everyone in Australia a suspect.
There's also a lack of direction as to how the data should be encrypted and no clear instruction that the data should be destroyed after the mandatory 2 years of storage. Why are both of these things a problem, Bernard?
A persistent pattern in everything we've discussed so far is the lack of expert or even reasonably well-informed guidance from the bureaucrats who are implementing this process, which is the Attorney General's Department. The Attorney General's Department began work on this whole issue of data retention way back in 2008, may well have been working on it much earlier. And yet, even, you know, as we've just heard, there's still debates and discussions about what metadata actually amounts to going on 9 years later. So that gives you a small indication of the extent to which it's been extraordinarily difficult for industry to, you know, even get a basic understanding of what the bureaucrats want them to actually store. This has flowed through to the implementation of the grants program as well. Recently, in a intelligence committee hearing, Attorney General's bureaucrats were asked if they had any idea where data is currently being stored. That is, you know, where are our major ISPs, our telcos, our service providers, where are they actually locating this data? Either data that they themselves keep for commercial purposes or data that they've begun retaining under data retention arrangements. And the bureaucrats didn't know and weren't really sure when or if they even would find out. So our government doesn't actually know where this data is being stored. There are no requirements relating to, as you've already said, where it's stored. It could be stored in China, it could be stored anywhere. Presumably it would be stored wherever it's cheapest. People consistently talk about China. And there's no requirements about the security with which it is stored. That is, the government's more or less left it to industry to protect this data, which is, of course, enormously attractive for commercial reasons, for criminal reasons, for intelligence reasons. And it's, as so many of us pointed out in our submissions to inquiries into this matter and since then, this is a real honeypot of information. And the problem with this sort of information is that it's deeply personal. It provides a rich, extraordinarily rich guide to your life. The classic quote from Ed Snowden is that you can't necessarily believe the content, but you can always believe the metadata. And that's absolutely right. The metadata about your life tells people far more about you than any content ever could. The security, therefore, of this data is absolutely essential, and yet the government doesn't really seem to be particularly interested in the extent to which it is securely kept. And of course, why should it? It's ultimately not really going to be hurt if, for example, a major telecommunications provider loses a trove of data or even accidentally releases it, which has been known to happen. That doesn't really matter to the government, but of course it matters awfully to the individuals whose privacy is affected.
So it sounds like I'm hearing across the panel a description of what seems to be pretty startling incompetence on the part of the government and just a lack of understanding of how this metadata works. What should the government do? Should they appoint an expert body to help advise them? How could they address this that they have no idea what they're doing?
I'll jump in on that. I mean, I think what they need to do is actually move away from the entire concept of mass surveillance. I mean, this is the core problem that's always been attached to data retention, whether it's here, whether it's overseas, is that this sort of mass surveillance, and it is mass surveillance, even if the data isn't actively monitored 24/7, is that it doesn't actually work in terms of improving the capacity of security agencies to prevent terrorism or deal with crime. And we've seen this tragically time after time after time in the series of terrorist incidents over the last 2 years. Virtually every single perpetrator of terrorist events, whether they've been in the United States, whether they've been in Europe, even in the case of Manharon Monis here in Australia, have been on the radar of security agencies or even well known for their terrorist affiliations well before they've carried out their attacks. Targeted surveillance is the best way to achieve the sort of security that advocates for data retention have been claiming they need data retention for, not mass surveillance of the kind that we now have. That's obviously not going to happen. The government's committed to data retention. I think what we do need is much, much stronger guidance in terms of legislation to protect the data that is being retained and to significantly tighten the circumstances in which it can be accessed by security agencies, because we're seeing data retained under the data retention laws by the admission of the head of ASIO being used to track down journalist sources. There's enormous potential for whistleblowers and other activists to be pursued using this data. And at the moment, the Attorney General's Department is conducting a review into whether its use should be expanded to include civil litigation, which is an absolute nightmare. Not merely in terms of scenarios like copyright holders pursuing file sharers, that's pretty small beer, but defamation litigants, family court litigants using data retained under data retention laws to go after people. So there's some pretty scary scenarios. I think, as always, the grim reality of these laws is the only thing we can hope for is to stop them getting worse, not to actually improve them.
We will talk about that inquiry on civil proceedings later in the show. John, did you have something you wanted to add on that?
I think it's important to remember that in terms of the law enforcement agency's access to telecommunications providers' metadata, we didn't come from a standing start. Even before the data retention legislation was put in place, there was on average more than 1,000 requests to the telecommunications industry every day for metadata access without a warrant. You know, that's a long-standing process. The fallacy that the government perpetrated about this was when George Brandis stood up in Parliament. He said, all this legislation is about is retaining the status quo. And the line was, there's a burning platform because telecommunications providers are starting to retain less data for shorter periods of time. So we want to put in place something that maintains the status quo. Well, that's wrong on two counts. I mean, firstly, the data retention legislation creates whole new categories of data that there's no need to store for operational purposes. Things like unsuccessful telephone calls, emails to addresses that are incorrect, a whole range of additional requirements that providers have had to create the means to retain. If it had really been about maintaining the status quo, the government could have just gone to the telecommunications providers and said, look, we want an enforceable undertaking that whatever you retain today, you'll continue to retain in the future. But it was much more than that the government had its ambitions set on.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. Who, in fact, are those agencies that now have access to the data, and what is it that they have to do to get it?
Well, there's a whole range of agencies. The official list, if you like, was reduced as part of the legislation, and it's typically police agencies, the various security agencies and others. The reality is, though, that quite outside that official list, there's a whole bunch of state and local government entities, like local councils, RSPCA, you name it, that have their own power to request under state legislation. So whereas the government sold this as, oh, look, it's now being restricted to a smaller number of agencies, we continue to see things like local councils seeking metadata so they can chase litterbugs and the like, and the RSPCA looking for information about dog owners. So whereas this was cast as a national security imperative, it's really a much broader scheme than that.
Obviously, keeping data costs money. So any idea of how much it is actually going to cost and who, in fact, is going to pay for it? Will it be the users in the end who have to pay for the storage of their own metadata?
Inevitably, if you put additional costs onto industry, you're going to generate a downstream effect for consumers. Now, the capital costs, the setup costs, were contributed to by government to the tune of about $130 million. So that was on budget. That's taxpayers' money. And that accounted for perhaps 60% of the costs actually incurred by providers just in setup. And then you've got the ongoing operational costs, all of the additional servers in data centres that are required to store the information, and the costs of retrieval on a regular basis. So there's not an exact figure. There was an estimate that was put together 4 or 5 years ago now that suggested the overall cost would be something like $700 million. Now, that hasn't been tested in a little while, but it is in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and it's an ongoing annual operational expense which the service providers have got to account for. So inevitably, you know, some of that ends up in the lap of consumers.
Bruce, from a legal point of view, does data retention amount to an invasion of privacy or indeed an infringement of our civil liberties?
Yes, it does. But unfortunately, because we don't have a National Bill of Rights, because we have a very, very weak national privacy regime and a state and territory weak privacy regime. So South Australia, for example, still hasn't bothered to get an Information Privacy Act of its own. Rather bizarre, if you're in South Australia, you're not protected, whereas in the ACT and New South Wales, you are. We have a weak legal framework that's very weakly administered by the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, the National Privacy Watchdog, which is the body, of course, that George Brandis unsuccessfully tried to get rid of on the grounds that, well, it would save a few million dollars and really privacy and the watchdog really aren't necessary. Unfortunately for George, he couldn't get that legislation through Parliament. So now we have a somewhat underfed and certainly very timid watchdog that will supposedly protect us if there are any problems. The watchdog historically has always agreed with the government. So we have very problematical protection, irrespective of whether you're doing anything wrong or you're completely innocent. And ultimately, this legislation means that all Australians are suspects.
It is worth noting that the Privacy Commissioner is planning to do audits of major providers in coming months to determine how well they are adhering to the Australian privacy principles in relation to the data retention regime. So I'm not arguing that the system is perfect, but Tim Pilgrim is planning, you know, some action.
With all respect, though, the principles are broad. They've historically been interpreted very broadly. And getting back to the question about resourcing, I think there are real questions about whether the Privacy Commissioner, the Information Commissioner, has both the smarts and, in essence, just the bodies on the ground to do meaningful privacy audits of very large corporations with an area of law, with an area of technology that's quite complicated.
Bernard, you said that data retention is not effective in combating terrorist attacks, and you're certainly not the only person saying that. If it doesn't, in fact, stop terrorist attacks, why do you think the Act made it through Parliament so easily? Was it just so that the government looked like they were doing something amid what was, in 2014, perhaps even a more heightened panic over terrorism? Or is there perhaps another more sinister reason that this was pushed through Parliament so quickly?
The process was actually fairly drawn out. I mean, Nicola Roxon, the Labor Attorney General, sought to have the issue of data retention considered by the Intelligence Committee when Labor was in government and ran afoul of the committee when it was chaired by Labor. So this is the second attempt by the Abbott government was obviously more successful. In terms of a sinister motive, well, I think the what we know about is sinister enough. I mean, the Attorney General's Department has been pushing for data retention for a long time. It's been pushing at the behest of security agencies, the AFP and ASIO, and has been trying to convince successive governments to implement it with as few restrictions as possible. And that process has been really based on the incapacity of politicians really just to push back against agencies when they say that, look, we're going dark, that's the phrase they use, we're going dark, we're losing access to information, we need these powers. And I think when someone like George Brandis, who obviously has no background in, as he displayed famously in trying to define metadata, when politicians have very limited understanding of even the most basic aspects of communications issues, then they're very easy to influence when it comes to security agencies looking to expand their powers. And I think that's what certainly happened in the case of data retention. And there was very little pushback to the basic idea that these powers were necessary to security agencies and that there was some sort of dire threat to their capacity to gather intelligence. And as we've already discussed, I mean, a key issue was this claim that this was about preserving the status quo, and that was self-evidently false. It was never about retaining the status quo. It was about dramatically expanding the powers of security agencies to access information. That was one of many points that never was really adequately addressed.
All right, so let's come back to this issue of civil proceedings. April 13 is also the date that the amendment prohibiting the use of metadata in civil proceedings comes into force. But it is possible that regulations could be approved by Parliament to allow exceptions. John, can you explain how metadata could be used in civil proceedings, and is this issue a cause for concern?
Well, there's been a lot of pretty excited debate about this question of civil litigant access to metadata, but it's not been particularly well informed. So I'll take you through, and bear with me because it's a bit of a mind bender, but this is the situation. If telecommunications providers have been retaining metadata for operational purposes or to comply with the data retention regime up until today, then that metadata always has been available and remains available to civil litigants if they manage to obtain a court order or a subpoena. So there's a long established tradition of those metadata being available. What changes from today is that if you are retaining metadata from today purely for the purposes of complying with the data retention regime, then that's not available to civil litigants. However, if you are retaining metadata from today for the purposes of complying with the data retention regime and also retaining it for an operational purpose, then it is available to civil litigants if they get a court order, but only for the duration of the period that you're retaining it for operational purposes. So, very clear, right? Now, because there's a lot of information, for example, like static IP addresses that providers might keep for 3 or 6 months, or the locational data around mobile phone calls that they might keep for a month or two. So once the period that they are keeping it for operational purposes expires, then it's no longer available. So what we're actually talking about from today is an expansion of the amount of information that is potentially available to civil litigants. But we're not talking about a sudden massive change in the availability of those data. They've always been available, provided you get the court order.
Who is to make that decision on what basis the data was kept? Is that something that the telco will self-report and promise they're telling the truth, that it was really just for compliance with the data retention rather than operational purposes?
Well, that's problematic for the telcos, frankly, and it's part of the reason, I guess, that the government's looking at whether these rules make sense, and they're obviously incredibly complex, as I've outlined. A telecommunications provider who receives a subpoena or a court order seeking data is now going to be in the position where they've got to look at each piece of the data and say, okay, how long have I been keeping this? Was I keeping it before April 13? Am I keeping it just for data retention purposes or for operational purposes as well? So it puts them in quite an invidious position of having to trawl through the data and make judgments about each element of it before they can decide whether to make it available. So ironically, from a service provider's point of view, the better two solutions would be open slather, it's all available, or nothing's available, because that at least makes it very clear as to what the courts can get access to. But we're in a halfway messy house at the moment, then that's part of what the government's trying to resolve, I guess.
You're listening to Fourth Estate. Let's move on and talk about journalist information warrants, which were introduced as an amendment to the amendment after outcry from the public and the media over the threat to freedom of press. Bernard, can you explain how these warrants work? Will they protect journalists and their sources?
The warrant is essentially a process whereby if an agency wants to access the data of a journalist for the purposes of identifying a source, they need to go through a much more elaborate process than they otherwise would. There needs to be a process by which an independent decision maker has to be convinced of the need to issue a warrant. According to the legislative criteria, there is a public interest advocate who will make the case, in a sense, for the journalist that their data should not be accessed, and the decision maker will then decide whether to provide the warrant that will enable the accessing of that information. All that, the entire process is conducted without the journalist or the media or anyone outside the process actually knowing that it's occurring. And if perchance a journalist happens to learn that that there's been an application to obtain their data, they are not permitted to reveal that. If they do, they can be sent to jail. In terms of whether it will protect anyone, it provides zero protection for journalists, more particularly for their sources, who are, of course, the target of such investigations. It is trivially easy to circumvent the journalist information warrant process, not by cheating it, not by breaking the law, but simply by going and obtaining data from people other than a journalist. For example, you want to find out who has leaked a document from a particular public service department to a journalist. There's no need to go and find the apply for a journalist information warrant to get the relevant journalist's metadata. You simply get the metadata of everyone in that public service department. You could probably narrow it down to a handful of people who would have access to that information, and you can identify who has, or at least you can certainly use the metadata from those people to find out whether any of them have contacted the journalist. That is, as long as you're getting the information of anyone who is not a journalist, you don't have to go through the hoops and hurdles of the journalist information warrant process. This whole journalist information warrant amendment was tacked on at a very late stage in the legislative process, when the government became concerned that a lot of journalists and media companies had very belatedly, woken up to the implications of data retention for their ability to protect their sources. It was tacked on, ineffectual, and as we've seen with the Australian Federal Police's NBN raids, as we've seen with Duncan Lewis, head of ASIO, he has actually said they've sought a journalist information warrant, but as I said, it is so trivially easy to actually obtain the same information without going through the process of a journal information warrant that it may as well not exist.
In fact, you wrote an article about Duncan Lewis and the revelation that ASIO had been granted access to journalist metadata by the Attorney General George Brandis, as you said. And in that article, you questioned whether Brandis had actually followed the law that was laid out in the journalist information warrant. So can you explain what you think he did or didn't do? And at the end of the article, you also said you would be happy to be proven wrong. Has that happened yet?
Well, so every time a journalist information warrant is sought in circumstances, normally the Attorney General presides over the process by which a journalist information warrant is obtained. In an emergency situation, the head of ASIO, if it's ASIO pursuing the warrant, can issue one themselves. They then need to report that to the Parliamentary Intelligence Committee. So there's a legislative requirement around these journalist information warrants that if they are actually sought, then the Parliamentary Committee that has oversight of intelligence agencies must be informed. Now, the question arose when Duncan Lewis actually said that ASIO had sought a journalist information warrant. Had he done what the legislation required him to do, which is to pass that information on to Parliamentary Committee, or had he passed that information on to the Attorney General in order to pass on to the committee? This all comes back to the circumstances in which this journalist information warrant process was put into the legislation. One of the things that the Parliament's Intelligence Committee was very keen to do is to have some sort of oversight of this process so that intelligence agencies and attorneys general couldn't simply go on their merry way without anyone knowing what was actually going on. So there's actually quite an important accountability requirement on the Attorney General and the heads of security agencies to report what they're doing when they start pursuing journalists and their sources. Now, as it turned out, there had been no report to the Parliamentary Intelligence Committee about a journalist information warrant. Now, what did that mean? Did that mean that Duncan Lewis had misspoken? Did that mean that George Brandis had not done what he was supposed to do under legislation? Well, it's still not very clear, and George Brandis and his office have persistently refused to answer any questions about that. What we do know is that a News Corp journalist was backgrounded that Duncan Lewis, in fact, was wrong and had not sought a journalist information warrant, or if he had, he hadn't actually told the Attorney General that he had. So the whole thing lost in a murk of national security obfuscation, which is one of the problems with this entire area. You can't have the normal process of media scrutiny, and you can't have the normal process of parliamentary scrutiny that most public servants are exposed to, because these agencies can operate virtually out of the public gaze and out of the media gaze, and it seems mostly out of the parliamentary gaze as well.
Bruce, is there any better way that press freedom could be protected by a different amendment to the Act, or is data retention fundamentally incompatible with the protection of journalists and their sources?
I think overall it's incompatible with the protection of Australian society. Certainly it's incompatible with the protection of civil liberties in Australia. And to make a rather cruel point, in 2012, Malcolm Turnbull, when he wasn't Prime Minister, gave a very, very eloquent oration, the Alfred Deakin oration, in which he utterly damned metadata retention. He claimed it was ineffective, it was not necessary, it would not work, it was abhorrent, it was un-Australian. Oh, what a difference it makes when you get into power.
All right, well, we're almost out of time, but a final question I'll ask everyone on the panel. Given that it looks like we're stuck with these data retention laws for the time being at least, what can journalists do to protect their communications and their sources?
Do exactly what Malcolm Turnbull and most of the Cabinet are doing, which is use an encryption system. Use Wicker or Whisper or a system like that. Journalists who are smart will subvert the system. So self-help is the remedy here, not law.
That answer's correct, I think. And in fact, you don't even have to be clever enough to use a virtual private network or one of the apps that were mentioned there. Gmail is beyond the reach of the data retention regime, which is one of the great ironies. You know, I've heard law enforcement agency officials say, well, aren't we lucky that all the crooks are on Big Pond? So there are significant gaps in the system.
Bernard, any tips there for journalists wanting to protect their sources?
Look, the other guys have said it pretty well. But the thing for journalists to bear in mind is you can only ever make yourself safer. You can't make yourself safe. And I think it's incumbent on every journalist who deals with a source who needs or wants to retain confidentiality to try to educate them as much as possible about staying secure. Because a lot of people come to journalists and in the first contact they make, they've already established an electronic trail that can be identified by authorities to track them down. So journalists have to be very, very careful about how they deal with sources and encourage sources to use basic IT security in the same way that journalists should be doing.
All right, that is all we have time for this week on Fourth Estate. Thanks to my guests, Bernard Keane. Thanks, Bernard.
My pleasure.
Bruce Baer-Arnold. Thanks for joining us, Bruce.
Pleasure.
And thanks for joining us in the studio, John Stanton.
Thank you, Olivia.
Do stay in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter and let us know if there are topics you want us to cover. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes or whatever podcasting app you're using. That helps other people to find the show and lets us know what you like and want more of. My name's Olivia Rosenman. Thank you for listening and see you next week.